Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of December. This hour of the program, what can we do to make our country safer? We'll have a couple guests with us. The United States Conference of Mayors sent a letter to the president and to members of Congress earlier this week saying again and again and again, Americans are stunned by senseless acts of violence involving guns. Friday's tragedy targeting young children in Newtown is incomprehensible too many times this year. Mayors have expressed shock at a mass shooting. Even more frequently, many of us must cope with the gun violence that occurs on the streets of our cities. They urged Congress and the president to take immediate action to ban assault weapons and other high-capacity magazines. They also urged a strengthening of the national background check system and eliminating loopholes in it, and strengthening the penalties for straw purchases of guns. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett will be joining us momentarily. We'll ask him what measures he supports, and we'll ask you what measures you support. Later this hour, Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at Harvard School of Public Health, who has conducted extensive research in injury and violence prevention. He looks at the effects of gunshots. He looks at the deficiencies of the Brady Law, and he says that where there are more guns, there is more homicide. We'll be welcoming your phone calls all hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us anywhere, if you'd like to send an email, that's talk@wpr.org. And if you would like to leave a message for us, which we would on this very important issue, like to read your comments, our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Mayor Barrett is joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. He has been meeting with mayors and has a meeting later today addressing this very issue, which many are addressing. Mayor Barrett, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
This was such a horror, wasn't it? Oh, my goodness.
I think for every American, for every parent in the world, seeing this happen was just a parent's worst nightmare. Because every parent believes when they send their child to school, they're sending their child to a safe place. And to have that be so tragically wrong is continuing to send shockwaves throughout every family in this country.
It sure is. What measures do you support, Mayor Barrett, to make us safer?
Well, there's a wide range of approaches I think that we have to take, but certainly you mentioned the items in the letter from the U.S. Conference of Mayors. I'm going to be part of a group of mayors today that will be contacting the president through Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which adopts many, if not all, of the same measures that you have mentioned. But I think most importantly right now, we have to be willing to even have the debate and have the votes. I'll give you my concern. My concern is in legislatures throughout the country and in Congress that once the horror recedes from this, that the subject will be changed again and again, and we won't have the urgency that Americans currently feel about addressing these issues. So I think what's unique about this tragedy is it really, really, I think, puts front and center just how we can't ignore this anymore. And I had done an opinion piece back in the summer following the tragedies in Wisconsin saying we have to have this debate now. But obviously that was not something that anybody wanted to debate at that time. But given the enormity of this, given the fact that we're talking about 6- and 7-year-old children and teachers, I am hoping that as horrible as this incident was, that it will lead us to have a serious conversation about gun violence and gun safety in the United States.
Do we need to do something immediately? Do we need to do something this week or next week? Is it too late to wait for the new session of Congress?
Well, the president has made it clear that he wants input from his cabinet members. I think later today, in fact, he may even be announcing the formation of a group to look at this. That was what the reports were in the media in Washington. And so he certainly, I think, has been personally moved by this, if you look at the news reports and if you look at the clips of him. And I think that he's taking this extremely personally. But my understanding is that he's going to announce a guns task force perhaps as early as today.
And please talk more about why it is. We have lived through all these horrors in Wisconsin, as you mentioned, the Sikh temple, the salon that took place. We've had gun violence in the city. The homicide rates have gone down, but we've dealt with this. You've dealt with this more than anybody as mayor and having to look at the horrors of gun violence on our streets. Why is it that we have put this off, and why might this be a moment when we'll take another direction?
Well, I think the opponents of change have been very, very effective through the political channels of making politicians back off from even challenging these issues. And I'm talking about not only conservative politicians, but more liberal politicians that they don't want to touch it. And I think it frankly, it goes all the way back to 1994 when the assault weapon ban was first passed, and it was following that election that the House flipped over to Republicans. And I know there were still people in 2000 when Vice President Gore lost to President Bush that said that his position on guns is what cost him the election, if you look at what happened in states like West Virginia. So to me, that's an explanation as to what has happened, but I don't think we can any longer wait. It is now time to have the national conversation and vote on these issues so that people know whether their elected officials are standing up for them or whether they're not standing up for them.
And when you look at public opinion polls, Mayor Barrett, indications are that they have changed and more Americans, although I'm not sure what steps they would support, do support more kinds of controls on guns. Does that make a difference to politicians when they look at those numbers of Americans who say you got to do something?
Well, it does, and quite honestly, I think that's one of the reasons there hasn't been action, because I would disagree with your statement that Americans have, at least for a long period of time, favored strengthening gun laws or gun safety laws. I remember looking, I don't know, in the last year, it was at one of the lowest points I've seen. Now, what I've seen in the last several days is that there has been a sea change in making sure, or in looking at that issue. But I think it's oftentimes it's how you phrase the question. I think most Americans assumed that in gun sales that people, there would be a check to see whether you had a criminal record or if you had mental health adjudication, or whether you had a outstanding or any historic order dealing with domestic violence. That may be true if you're purchasing a gun through a federally registered gun dealer. But if you're purchasing it online, if you're purchasing it at a gun show, if you're purchasing it privately, I think most Americans would be surprised to learn, well, no, there's no check on that. And I think most Americans agree, even those politicians who historically have been against any type of gun safety laws have said, well, the real issue here is mental illness. And I think you have to be careful there, but taking their argument at face value that the mental illness issue has to be front and center. There are many, many guns that are sold in this country in gun shows, online, and in private sales where a person may even have an adjudication relating to a mental illness, but it's never checked. It is never checked, and a gun sale is consummated.
It would seem to me that most Americans and that Congress could take up the issue of everybody should have a background check. You shouldn't be able to buy these guns on the internet willy-nilly or go to a gun show and just pick up a gun. That most people would agree that at least we could do that, don't you think?
Well, it hasn't happened, but again, I think when people hear that, their first reaction might be no, that we check that. Again, if you go through a federally registered dealer, you do check those things, but many of these sales are not occurring through those dealers.
Our guest, the second part of this show from Harvard, has done an extensive study of state-level legislation aimed at reducing unauthorized access to firearms. He says that where there are more guns, there is more homicide. Do you believe that?
Well, I haven't seen the study, but I do know that what we're hearing right now is we're hearing from, again, the people who have opposed a lot of these gun laws are saying, well, if the teachers had just been armed.
Right.
And I looked at that, and what comes to my mind immediately is the tragedy that occurred in 2009 at Fort Hood, which was a military base, where you had shooting that occurred in November of 2009 at Fort Hood, and there were 12 people there were 12 people killed and 31 were wounded, and that was on an Army base, and there's a lot of guns on an Army base. So this whole notion that somehow we want to have our kindergarten teachers armed, to me, just defies logic.
I can't believe there would be too many teachers who would want to take that as part of their job responsibility.
I totally agree.
Let's go to phone calls for you. We have many. Mayor Tom Barrett is our guest. The first part of this show, our phone number is 800-486-8655. The mayor did mention that the president will be announcing, I think there's a press conference at 10:45. I don't know if that's Eastern or our time, to announce that Vice President Biden will lead a national effort to gather information and to determine what the national policy will be to reduce gun violence. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We start with Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks. We need a massive public service announcement and that looks at the launch of the amendment, well-regulated militia being necessary. That's step one. Step two is I own cars. Every year I have to have them relicensed. Guns, I think, are at least as dangerous as cars. I own a gun. I have no objection to subjecting myself in the way that as I age, someday somebody's going to say to me, your eyesight and your hearing or your reflexes aren't good enough, Rich. You shouldn't be driving anymore. I think annually people should be willing to go through community class training and assessment.
Okay, your phone is kind of cutting out, but I think Mayor Barrett got what you were saying.
Well, I think the first step, again, is to make sure that the guns are not getting into the wrong hands. And that's why these background checks are so important. And that's why I think that's where the focus should be right now, is making sure that people who have criminal records, who have domestic violence orders, who have adjudicated mental health issues and serious mental health issues, that we are not allowing guns to get in their hands.
And how does that happen? You, of course, have studied that in the city of Milwaukee. Those people who should not have guns, who do have guns, how are they getting them?
Oh, a lot of them can be purchased on the street. One of the things that we as a city have tried, and it's in our legislative package before the state legislature right now, is this whole notion of straw purchases. Those are the purchases that occur when an individual has a criminal record, so he cannot go into a gun store and purchase a gun legally. But he may bring his girlfriend in, he may bring his brother in, he may bring a friend in, and that straw purchaser purchases the gun, and then they leave the store. We don't know what happens to it. We do know that there are times when they show up in crime reports that the gun was purchased by someone and then given to the felon. And we want that to be a felony in the state of Wisconsin.
Thanks, Rich, for your call. John in Green Bay, hi.
Hi, good morning. You know, I think there's just a lot of real simple things that can be done. I think there's one question I have and then a comment. One is I'd like to see data that would say people that use guns for hunting versus people who just use guns for sport or for hobby or so forth, and the crime rates compared to the people who are committing these acts that are hunters. I think there's just an inherent deeper sense of appreciation for what that gun can do and the respect for the gun. But on the flip side of that, just a comment, I spent 25 years in public education and in schools. I think that there would be a place for a volunteer type task squad that would act as a defense mechanism in a high school with some proper training. I mean, a lot of us are ex-military. We've talked about it in faculty lunchrooms that, you know, it would make the most sense. We would do it. There'd be some extra pay, of course, but it would certainly be a voluntary thing. But I think, you know, nobody knows the school better than the faculty that have been there 20 years. And a lot of us go off and drills, reserve weekends, and National Guard weekends, and are still serving their country. We certainly would serve the school we work in.
Well, and there certainly is nothing that currently prohibits volunteers. Well, maybe there, I don't know what the local rules are, but prohibits people from helping provide the defense of schools. I think the question is, do you want guns in schools? I think that's the basic question. And again, I go back to Fort Hood, where you had a situation where the Army psychiatrist killed 12 people on a military base. And so this whole notion that somehow the answer is to put more guns in the hands of people in these fragile settings, to me, I'm not buying that. And I don't know that most Americans buy that.
Thanks for the call. Jerry in Glendale. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the state of Wisconsin, been working professionally in the field of mental health for the past 42 years. In order to have my license renewed so that I can practice psychotherapy, every 2 years I have to go through 30 hours of approved continuing education in my clinical area of practice. I find it amazing that the concealed carry legislation within the state of Wisconsin is so loosely defined. Here I have to do 30 hours of continuing education to protect the public that I serve from unscrupulous or uninformed activities, and people who can carry lethal weapons do not have any requirement for training, continued training, or getting relicensed. I'll take your comments off the air.
Thanks, Jerry.
Well, I think that the proponents of the concealed carry would argue that there are training requirements. I think that they're very loose training requirements. But I think that the point is important, that we want to make sure, and all this has to be done within the context of the Second Amendment. And so any changes that are being debated need to fit within the contours of the Second Amendment. And I think that everything that's being discussed in the last 72 hours would fit that definition, that we are not talking about taking away the guns of people who are hunters. We're not even talking about taking away the guns of people who use them in their homes for self-defense or for shooting. We want to keep the guns out of the hands of people who legally cannot have those guns. And then there's the question of, do you need 30 bullets to shoot a deer, for example? And do they have to be the type of bullets that are designed to cause more bodily damage? I think those are legitimate public policy issues for debate.
Well, Senator Feinstein's initial remarks about the bill that is being formulated, the bill to ban assault weapons and other high-capacity magazines, will that be problematic to pass Congress, do you think, Mayor Barrett?
Oh, it'll certainly be incredibly, incredibly controversial. There's no question about that. But if you go back in time, and it was actually back in 1989 in Stockton, California, and you may not remember this, some may remember it, that was when there was a shooting at an elementary school, and there was five children that were killed there. A teacher was killed there. The assailant had an AK-47 rifle with at least 106 bullets, and that's what led to the enactment of the assault weapon ban in California. This obviously is even more horrific than that in terms of the number of children dying. And so I think that if you use that Stockton, California as an indicator, I think that we will see some action, at least in some states and hopefully nationally as well.
Why have we used the Second Amendment to allow us to buy those kinds of weapons? I don't understand that. Do we need to have, I don't even know if you'd have a congressional conversation about what it means in 2012?
Well, the court decisions on the Second Amendment have been evolving in the last 10 years, where for the first time the Supreme Court basically extended the Second Amendment to the states, and it did so after it had made an initial determination that the amendment allowed for private individuals to have the guns. In essence, that it wasn't dealing with the issue of the militia; it was for people to have the guns.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know at the end of the day what the Supreme Court would say. But I think that the decisions that it has rendered already. Those decisions do not say that there's an unlimited right to have a gun. In other words, I don't think anybody is saying, okay, you should be able to have a bazooka or a tank or even a fully automatic military weapon. So there are lines to this that even the Supreme Court which is more conservative, has drawn.
Glenn in Manitowoc, hi.
Oh, good morning. Yeah, I'm really listening to your program. I don't have any answers other than a comment that you had a caller yesterday that pointed out a very good point in regards to in the 60s and early 70s, you didn't have these problems, but you do now, and they're incredibly severe. I look at it more as our society has degenerated to the point, especially in politics, you can see it, where we just simply don't talk to each other or respect each other's view. And to really address this problem, what's needed is don't just focus just on the guns, but as a society as a whole, we don't respect each other. In this subject, gun advocates ought to be invited to the discussion, and it's the moderates in all subjects that really hold sway. I met Mr. Barrett in Manitowoc once already. Then I talked to him on your radio show during the race. Look at our politics. Fanatical people are becoming fanatics in this country with no respect to each other's views.
Mayor Barrett.
Well, I totally agree that gun advocates have to be part of this conversation, and that the moderates will, at the end of the day, probably, and maybe rightfully so, be the ones that will decide what direction the country goes on these issues. And I think that that makes sense, because I don't know that we want to have these wild pendulum swings one direction to the other, and I don't think that's where the country is. I think the country supports the legal ownership of guns. I know the country supports the legal ownership of guns for hunting, for self-defense, for sport shooting, but I think that the public also expects policymakers to have in place laws to ensure that people with criminal records, with serious mental health problems, and with domestic violence backgrounds don't have access to guns, particularly those guns that can wreak havoc and mayhem in literally seconds.
And there is something about what's happening to the national soul here. I'm sure you would agree, Mayor Barrett. As the president said when he spoke so movingly in such an important address at Newtown, we just can't tolerate this anymore. You can't have the shooting at the Sikh temple, the shooting at Aurora, the shooting in Portland, this horrendous massacre in Newtown week after week after week. We just can't take it.
Well, and I think that your statement is accurate in that it used to be this would occur once a decade, another decade, then it became yearly. Now it's monthly, maybe even weekly, that we're seeing this happen.
Right. So why is that?
Well, I think obviously you have guns out there right now that individuals can get their hands on. They can kill a lot of people at a very, very fast pace. And so by having them out there, having them so popular, I don't know why anybody is shocked.
So what are you doing today to address this issue in Washington?
Well, I've had a couple meetings yesterday. I'll be coming back to Milwaukee today. But to me, this is an issue that has to be addressed at the state level and at the national level. At the state level, just so you and your listeners know, many years ago, the states took away the ability of local governments to pass laws dealing with these issues. So all of the activity and the focus has to be on the state of Wisconsin, and then obviously at the federal level, to make sure that you're dealing with issues like federal gun trafficking, assault weapons nationally. All of those issues become important both at the state and the federal level.
Thank you, Mayor Barrett, very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mayor Tom Barrett joining us by phone from Washington, D.C. today to reiterate the U.S. Conference of Mayors sent an open letter to the president and to the Congress calling for stronger gun laws and more mental health funding. We are going to, in just a moment, be meeting the Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health, Matthew Miller. He has conducted extensive research in injury and violence prevention. He has looked at guns, possession of guns all over the world. He has looked at what states are doing, and we'll be meeting him and talking with him in just a moment. Continuing to take your phone calls, our number is 800-486-8655. Our lines all week on these issues have been extremely busy, so in case you can't get through, you can send an email, talk@WPR.org, or you can leave messages for us on our Facebook page, and that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program this Wednesday, it may be the most influential essay ever written. We'll be talking, it's our book club, about civil disobedience, Henry David Thoreau's 1849 essay. And that's coming up after 10 o'clock. Joining us now, Matthew Miller, Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's a physician. He has been trained in internal medicine, medical oncology, medical ethics, injury prevention, epidemiology, and health policy. And he has written many articles and book chapters on fatal and non-fatal violent injuries. He's done an analysis of the effect of state-level legislation aimed at reducing unauthorized access to firearms on the rate of violent death among Americans. And we'll look at some of those laws the next part of our program and welcome phone calls for Dr. Miller, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Dr. Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Is it fair to say generally that your studies show where there are more guns, there is more homicide?
That is that's a fair overview of what our studies here at the Harvard Injury Center have shown. Certainly, in international comparisons, it's abundantly clear that the United States, which is an outlier in terms of the number of firearms in civilian hands, but not in terms of the amount of crime or non-lethal violence, that the United States has a homicide rate that is an order of magnitude higher than, say, the other high-income nations, even though our rates of violent victimization that is not fatal is really no different.
When you looked at state-level legislation that's been aimed at reducing unauthorized access to firearms, what have you found to be effective?
So what we have done is look at the availability of firearms in people's homes, the prevalence of household firearm ownership across the 50 states. And what we found, when you adjust for underlying rates of violent victimization and crime, that those places, those states where there are more guns have higher rates of homicide. That's true for men, that's true for women, and that's true for children. Now, you can't do an apple-to-apple comparison of states that have high gun ownership to states that have low gun ownership without attempting to adjust for things like urbanization. We know that suicide rates are higher, for example, in rural areas, but crime is higher in urban areas. So you need to compare comparable levels of urbanization. And when you do that, what you find is the states with more stringent firearm laws have lower levels of firearm ownership and lower levels of overall homicide. And the reason they have lower levels of overall homicide is because they have lower levels of homicide due to firearms. The rates of homicide due to other methods, knives, and so forth, is really not that different from one state to the other, but the rates of firearm-related homicide, which drives the overall rates of homicide, is hugely different.
I know that you have, and this has been a problem, there have been cases of this reported in the news this week of children who are harmed by guns, who get access to guns. Tell me about what kinds of bills have been introduced and perhaps passed that would keep children in the home safer?
The best way to protect your children is to make a decision in the enlightened self-interest of everyone in the household to take the gun out of the home. There are lots and lots of studies, every single case control study that has been done in the United States that has looked at whether children living in homes with guns are safer than children living in homes without guns, has found that the risk of violent death to children is much higher, 2 to 5-fold higher, depending on how the guns are stored or whether there are guns in the home. This is what you can do as a parent to protect your child is to remove the gun from the home. There's nothing that you can do that would reduce that child's risk of suicide or homicide or accidental firearm death. Hmm. And so I think it's worth mentioning that among people under the age of 40, the leading causes of death are not diseases. Children do not die of heart disease or cancer at rates that compare to the rates at which they're dying, firstly of suicide and secondly of homicide, most of which are due to firearms. It may come as a surprise to some of the listeners that more than half of all suicides in this country are due to guns, as well as two-thirds of all homicides. And then, in fact, there are more gun-related suicides than there are gun-related homicides in the United States. Hmm.
And we're looking at not an inconsequential number of those.
No, we're talking about 19,000 suicides due to guns for all ages combined, and 11,000 homicides due to guns. Now, there are about 38,000 suicides overall. Half are due to guns, and about 16,000 homicides, 11,000 of which are due to guns.
One of the national conversations that has been taking place since last Friday is the huge number of people who do not have background checks, the gun shows, the internet purchase of guns.
Yeah.
You've done some research on the effects of gun shows, haven't you?
I haven't, but I'm familiar with some of the scholarship that has been done on it. And a consistent sort of public health message that comes across is that, at the very least, a really sensible first step is to have universal background checks so that people cannot sell guns to other people or transfer guns to people without knowing at least something minimal about the person to whom they are selling or transferring a firearm. Right now, 40% of all firearm transactions occur without a background check through these other channels, and if a courageous conservative Republican were to stand up and say enough is enough, what we need is a universal background check, and would stand up behind that, I think the country would rally behind that person, and he would be a hero or she would be a hero, and that to take a courageous stance and not one that is just concerned about being taking cover could really, I think, help galvanize meaningful change in the United States. And that's a totally sensible regulation that's adopted by many states like Massachusetts and California, and all of Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But we need a courageous conservative Republican to say enough is enough. And to stand up, and I think President Obama could call on all members of Congress to back such a proposal. And those who decide that they don't want to need to explain to a first and second grade classroom in their constituency why they want to make it easy for people with criminal records and mental health problems to obtain guns.
It does seem like such a common sense public health right thing to do, doesn't it?
It does to me. It does to me. I think the litmus test is really speaking to your 6 or 7 year old and going into your local school and telling those kids why you oppose a universal background check. And if you can't do that, then you should, you know, step forward and support this entirely reasonable, moderate first step.
So many are saying that because of what happened last Friday, we will see maybe not one, but more than one conservative hero calling for what you just said.
I welcome that and think that the American public would also reward that act of courage and reexamination rather than punish it. You can't take the lead from the threat, implied or explicit, that the NRA has issued, their grading system. Because to me, the NRA is more like the Wizard of Oz than it is like any other character that I can summon. I mean, there's a lot of bluster and fear that they play on, but things seem to me to be different this time. I think the American public has been shocked and to re-examine with an open mind and with a strained conscience what role firearms should play in the society that we want to live in and pass on to the next generation.
We welcome phone calls. Dr. Matthew Miller is our guest, associate professor of health policy and management at Harvard School of Public Health. He is a physician trained in many areas. For purposes of our conversation, we highlight injury prevention, and also he's done extensive empirical research in injury and violence prevention and has written extensively about this. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Jane in Fort McCoy is our first caller for you, doctor. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Say, you know, we are the most warlike nation in this whole world. You know that. I think we all know that. And also, more importantly, you can base this on our game, our sport, you know, football, hockey, very violent, and video games now. Very violent. Can you imagine without any supervision at home and a moderately mentally ill child taking out lives on a video game? And even if it's black blood, as you know what I mean, you know, there's got to be internet control. There are so many things. And we have to start again all over, I think. And the civil rights to bear arms, we need that. That is our right. But there's got to be a way to earn that right. And I would like to hear your response.
Dr. Miller.
So thanks for your comments, Jane. The United States is a country that is not actually more violent than other high-income countries. We do not have higher rates of aggressive behavior. We do not have higher rates of criminal violence. We don't have higher rates of rape or robbery or assault. What we do have is higher rates of lethal violence. And that the reason that we have higher rates of lethal violence without higher rates of underlying violence in general is because when we are violent, we're much more likely to use a firearm, which makes it much more likely that somebody's going to end up dead. And so I think when taking a public health approach to trying to prevent lethal violence, and I include in lethal violence both violence directed at other people, murder, and violence directed at the self, suicide, both of which characterized the horrific events of this past Friday. You have to recognize that there are two ways to try to prevent these things from happening. One is to do everything you can to prevent people from getting to a point where they snap or where they're overwhelmed by grief and try to take their own life or someone else's life. And it turns out that it's incredibly hard to change human behavior. Worth trying, and investing in. But there's a second way you can prevent lethal violence, and that's by making it harder for people that you can't prevent from acting against other people or against themselves to die in those impulsive, aggressive acts. And the key there is to reduce the availability of firearms to people who are vulnerable to snapping or going through a really bad spell, especially young people. This is a lesson that we have learned from preventing unintentional injuries like motor vehicle crashes. For 50 years, we tried to reduce the rate at which people died in motor vehicle crashes, and we had driver's education programs, and we had public messaging that urged people to please drive safer. And for 50 years, we made very little progress because we were trying to change human behavior. What is it that actually resulted in the profound drop in motor vehicle fatalities that characterized the past 50 years? making it harder for people to die when they lose control, when they get into crashes. So I'm talking about having collapsible steering columns. I'm talking about having cars that accordion and absorb the energy, of changing the structure of roadways so that when people roll over, they don't smash into a tree, but they go into a shoulder that's designed to absorb the energy and anticipate the behavior that's really difficult to stop. We need to recognize that it's really hard to change human behavior. It's worth trying to, and it can happen in over long periods of time by changing the cultural narrative around certain types of behavior like drunk driving. But the biggest bang for the buck in reducing motor vehicle fatalities was changing the environment, the physical environment, and then the cultural environment. And that same strategy applies to reducing lethal violence, homicides, and suicide.
Dr. Matthew Miller, our guest, what does Congress need to do? We'll ask him in a moment and take more of your phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's our December book club, next hour of the program, and we'll be talking about Henry David Thoreau's extremely influential essay, Civil Disobedience. Back to phone calls. Ron in Whitefish Bay. Hi.
Hi. I think I agree with a lot of what the guest is saying and the guest that you had on yesterday, but what everybody's kind of forgetting is the largest elephant in the room is that there are just too many damn handguns, that if we banned all handguns, if we took all handguns off the street, didn't manufacture them and so forth, how many lives would then be saved? And I'm not saying, I agree that people need, can have a rifle to go deer hunting or a shotgun to go duck hunting and so forth, but there's no damn reason whatsoever that a person needs a handgun. And your guest pointed out, it's an illusion to have a gun in your house or a carry concealed weapon. It's an illusion for you to think that you are going to feel safer.
Dr. Miller.
Ron, I think that you have, hit the nail on the head with respect to a number of issues. One is that it is an illusion to think that you're safer, to use your words. I couldn't agree more. And what needs to be done is to shine the light of science onto the reality of owning a gun and the risks and benefits that you assume when you purchase a gun and that you impose on other people in your home and in your neighborhood when you make that decision, and to allow people to struggle with the actuarial realities that apply to having handguns around. Let me tell you, there was a study that we did that relates to Ron's hope that we could live in a world where there were no handguns in civilian hands. I mean, right now, 1 in 3 homes have firearms. And we have to start with the reality of where we are and what steps we can take to improve the social welfare. But if you ask people in a survey, as we did, kids, even gang members, would they rather live in a world where it was easy to get a gun, hard to get a gun, or impossible to get a gun? They overwhelmingly said, we would rather live in a world where it was impossible to get a gun. Now, these are people, many of whom own guns, and they prefer to live in a world without guns, to help move towards a place where we're a safer society. And people recognize that having a gun actually imposes risk on other people as well as themselves. It is the first step towards getting people to act in the kind of enlightened self-interest that in Ron's case would mean getting rid of any household handguns that he has.
What kind of national legislation do you think should be first and foremost, and keep in mind what is likely to pass the Congress when you answer?
Well, as I said at the beginning of the show, I think what the first step should be no loopholes. And another way of framing that is universal background checks for everyone who wants a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said earlier as well, if you don't agree with that, I think every politician should have to take a stance on that. And if they disagree with that, they need to explain it to a first and second grade classroom in their district.
What's number two on the list? Would you agree that it looks like we're going to have a bill introduced banning assault weapons and other high-capacity magazines?
Yeah, high-capacity magazines, for sure. Assault weapons, definitely. There's no reason that we should live in a society where you can purchase ammunition and a kind of firearm that can pierce the Kevlar vests that police who are trying to protect us wear. I mean, why should anyone be able to outgun the police who are trying to protect us? You don't need these sorts of weapons to hunt or to protect yourself. So yeah, that's a no-brainer. Mm. But the one that's going to have the largest public health effect is to have universal background checks.
Mm-hmm. Sergio in Osceola, hi.
Hi, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And, I really do feel like it's not the government's place to tell us what we need, even, you know, regarding body armor. You can go anywhere in any city and be struck by a car, get hit in the back of the head with a lead pipe by a drunk. I mean, you know, I think it's politically ignorant to address guns in such a tragic, you know, event such as what happened in Newtown. The Newtown shooter was denied purchase of a gun from a legal standpoint, trying to purchase one legally because of mental illness.
I don't know that. I haven't heard that.
Oh, that either.
No, I don't think that. You got to get the facts straight on this story. He got the guns from
his mother.
I think you have to have a conversation about guns. I mean, you just have to after an event like this. Let's go next to Brad in Green Bay. Hi, Brad.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, you know, everybody keeps talking about the gun issue. What about the mental health issue here? I mean, you know, in Wisconsin, my ex-wife, she's a social worker for, working with mental health people and stuff like that. I mean, why wasn't this guy in at the hospital and stuff? I own guns. I trained my son. He's 10 years old. He target practices with me. You know, I keep it locked and I keep the gun in a lock and safe.
Okay, why should there be more focus on mental health, Dr. Miller?
Well, I think there certainly is a huge need for better mental health care, better access to mental health, and better treatments that need to be developed. But in thinking about the role of mental health in this tragedy, it clearly played a role. But we are not a country that's more mentally ill or violent than other countries that have much, much lower rates of homicide and much lower rates of these mass slaughterings. If you look at other high-income countries, the reason that they have fewer massacres than we do isn't because they have better mental health care or because there are fewer people with mental illness. It's because when people who have enormous hostility within them, whether it's from mental illness or not, act out and snap, here they snap and have easy access to guns. In Western Europe, they snap and they have easy access to knives. And the outcome is dramatically different. You know that on the same day that the Sandy Hook massacre occurred, there was an attack in China by a man wielding a knife, also on grade school children. And in that attack, he injured a number of children, and none died. He didn't have, because civilians in China don't have guns. It would have been no different from Sandy Hook. But what distinguishes the violence in this country from the violence in other high-income countries is that our violence is lethal because we have easy access to guns. The mental health problem is huge, but the lethal consequences of not attending to mental health issues, at least as in distinction to other countries, has to do with the ready availability of guns.
We only have 10 seconds. Are all your studies available in some place we can go?
Yes, if you go to the Harvard Injury Control Research Center.
Harvard Injury Control Research Center.
And look, just Google that.
Okay.
We're at the Harvard School of Public Health. You will come to our website and you can navigate. You can navigate through that site for summaries of some of the seminal articles.
Okay.
And references to other literature.
Thank you, Dr. Miller, so much for being with us. Dr. Matthew Miller, Associate Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Harvard School of Public Health. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. Thanks for all of your calls. News is coming up in just a moment.